Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. A little later on in the hour, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron will be here to answer your plant questions. But we're going to start with insects today. And depending on your point of view, you may think the insect we're talking about today is really cool or maybe a little bit creepy. Either way, praying mantises are pretty easy to spot this time of year. And Iowa State University entomology professor Donald Lewis is here to tell us about this unusual insect. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
It's always a pleasure.
And this is, I think, one of the most recognizable insects out there. And also, there's people think they know a lot about them and maybe don't know a lot about them. But they are, from my perspective, really cool. I'm guessing you're in the same camp.
Yes. And it's one of those insects that attracts attention. It's big, for one thing. And any insect that exceeds 2 to 3 inches, and praying mantids can go up to 4 inches or so, anything that large is going to attract attention and people are going to know about it simply because of its dimensions. Then there's this overall appearance that this was an insect built by a committee, that part of the committee had some spare parts for front legs that are these huge grasping things, and another group had this little triangular head, and then they had this really long abdomen, and they all got together and threw their parts in, and we end up with an insect that doesn't look very well put together, but it works for them.
Well, it also looks a little like people might imagine alien life forms might look.
Well, yes, it is. And to add to the sort of the creepy factor is praying mantids will spin that small triangular head, which almost appears to be able to spin 360 degrees. They will spin and look at you, which is a little disconcerting. That
with their compound eyes.
With their big eyes. That's right. They have these huge eyes that allow them to see prey that is moving. If the prey would stand very still, they probably wouldn't get caught. But all of those things together just add up to something that we recognize, we've heard a lot about, we may have heard some things that aren't true, but generally, people do know what a praying mantis is, and they know what they do.
Well, let's talk about, we've used the word prey and the word prey. So let's use some definitions here, because they do prey on smaller insects, right? But that's not what they're named for.
Right. And it's there are two spellings for the word prey. If something comes along and eats you, you are their prey, and that's P-R-E-Y. But if you hold your hands up in the motion of the praying hands, that's P-R-A-Y, and that's what the praying mantis is doing. Those front legs are barbed, spined, raptoral, pinching machines, and they use those very effectively to snap out in a microsecond and capture small insects, other prey, in a grasp that impales them. The more they struggle to escape, the more those spines dig into them and hold them in place. Praying mantis is an indiscriminate, cold-blooded killer. And that, you know, that doesn't really square with something that we think we like.
But what do they eat?
Well, mostly they would prey on other small arthropods. So they're eating small insects, but it has to be things that crawl past them. So the aphids that are on your milkweeds right now, those bright yellow oleander aphids, aren't going to be eaten by praying mantids because they're not moving past. But a cricket that jumps through their field of view, a grasshopper that jumps through their field of view, even butterflies and bumblebees will be snatched out of the air as they're moving past in front of the face and be eaten. One of the most disturbing sights on the internet are the pictures of hummingbirds that have been captured and eaten by praying mantids. So they're not very picky what they eat. Anything from small insects to small arthropods, other arthropods, all the way up to hummingbirds.
Wow. Eating hummingbirds does not make them sound very beneficial.
Well, but... and in fact, when they're eating bees that visit the flowers where the praying mantids are sitting, suddenly what we think of as our natural pest control is killing our pollinators.
Right.
So it, being an indiscriminate predator, it may not really help much.
All right. How many different kinds of praying mantids live in Iowa?
And it's interesting, we can say mantid with a D on the end, or we can say mantis with an S on the end, and it's all the same thing. Mantids are mantises, and mantises are mantids, and so forth. There's only about 20 species of praying mantids in North America, and there's only about 2,300 species in the entire world. So this is not a huge group like beetles and butterflies and some other things that have had evolution into large areas. And for one thing, it takes a lot of food to keep a praying mantis alive, to keep them growing. And you can't have a lot of them in one area, so that may have held down the number of species as well.
All right. So we do see them this time of year. Are they considered to be common?
You know, they're not common, they're not rare. So we need a word that's in between common and rare. And the best I've ever come up with is to say they're moderately common. And people can go a few years and not see one, and suddenly they see two of them. It's not like seeing fireflies over a soybean field on a summer night. They're not abundant in that form. So they're common but not abundant, I think, is a good way to sort of describe that. Yeah, they're out there. Now, what's interesting and what has changed in the time of my career is how far north in Iowa we can find them. It used to be we would only hear from them from the southern counties in the state. And now we hear about praying mantids from central Iowa up into Waterloo and Sioux City.
Very interesting. And they, for the people who think they look creepy, are they dangerous at all? Can they hurt you?
They can hurt you. I can speak from personal experience on this one. Normally, I have to tell you what I've read in a book, but I was just checking to see how strong the grip was of the praying mantis front legs and got my fingertip into the jaw part of where the two pieces of the leg come together, and the spines actually broke the skin.
Wow. So you found that it was quite strong.
They're quite strong, and those spines are quite sharp. You know, well, there was no lasting effect. I lost a little drop of blood to the benefit of scientific discovery, but it was not a big deal.
Right. If you don't want your finger poked, though, don't stick your finger in there.
That's right. Leave them alone. They're easy to pick up by the thorax, that long, slender piece in the back, and you can handle them. You can let them crawl on you. Just don't wiggle your finger like a bee in front of their face.
All right. And why do we see them more this time of year?
Well, they're in the adult stage.
They're big.
They're big. They have grown. Our mantids spend and we should clarify that the one we're talking about, the 3 to 4 inch long one in Iowa, is called the Chinese mantid. It was brought here from China back in the 1800s and released in the southern United States. Has now spread to a lot of at least the eastern half of the country. That species is one that we see a lot of and one that gets around because you can buy egg cases. And those egg cases are how the mantid spends the winter. So if we get a mild winter and all those eggs hatch, we get little tiny quarter-inch mantids the following May. Nobody notices those little tiny ones, but they've been out there in the garden, in the field, in the prairie. They've been eating and growing all summer, and now that they've reached the adult stage, and especially since they're attracted to the lights on the side of your building, we're more likely to see them in late summer and fall.
All right, and the ones that we're seeing right now that some of us are so fond of, they're near the end of their life cycle, right?
They should have mated by now. Many of them have already laid their eggs. They may have another month to do that. They lay anywhere from 150 to 200 eggs in a foamy ball about the size of a golf ball that's usually attached to a plant stem 2 to 3 feet off the ground. So people see these clumps of foam, dried foam, on their plant, and they think it might be a gall, they think it might be a plant deformation. That is the egg case of the praying mantid that's going to get them through the winter so they can start over next year with one generation per summer.
And a lot of people like to collect those egg cases and then wait for them to hatch in the spring. What's your advice for somebody who might want to do that?
And people buy them. You can buy these online. You can buy them in biological control supply stores. And you can release them into your garden. And we've talked about how much good that's likely to do your garden. But they are fun to watch. The egg cases are set to stay cold the duration of the winter. And if you bring them in, say, January or February, and you're watching them inside your house, the eggs are likely to hatch in the middle of winter. And at that point, you have 150 little babies looking around for something to eat, and you've got
nothing to feed them.
Nothing to feed them. They will start eating each other, and there's not much satisfaction or not much of a teaching moment in that. And it's too cold to let them outside. So the advice is leave your praying mantis egg case in the garage on the unheated porch and begin to watch it in May.
All right. And then it could be really cool.
And then it'll be fun to watch.
Now, I have to, speaking of mating and reproduction, I have to ask you the question that every elementary school student within us wants to know. Does the female praying mantis really eat her mate?
There's even a term for this. It's called sexual cannibalism. And it does happen in some insects. It happens in some other animals. And it's widely reported, or at least widely believed, to be the case with the praying mantis. And if you go back through and try to read this, you'll find out that often these observations were made in captivity.
Mm.
That if you crowd too many males and females close together, apparently some of them get a little grumpy and the male's more likely to be eaten. Sexual cannibalism does happen in the wild, but it's not with every species. It's not with every mating. So it's out there, but it's not as common as people want to believe it is.
All right. And now the elementary school student within all of us is very disappointed, Donald.
Well, yeah, you know, bursting bubbles is part of what we have to do. But it's sort of like the story of the Black Widow spider. It became a myth that that's how they all reproduce, and we believe that of mantids as well.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me, Iowa State University entomologist Donald Lewis. We've been talking about praying mantises. Of course, you're welcome to ask questions about those insects and any others. Richard Geron's going to join us in a moment to answer your plant questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions about plants or insects. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, is joining the conversation now. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And you may get a little bit of a break because we've got a lot of praying mantis questions.
That's okay. I can take a nap.
But stay with us.
Okay.
I'm sure we'll have plants soon. Iowa State University entomology professor Donald Lewis is also here, and let's get to some of these praying mantis questions. Mary is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Mary. Oh, maybe Mary is not on the line. Sorry about that. Heidi is on the line in LeClaire. Hi, Heidi.
Hi there, Charity and Mr. Lewis and Richard. I have an experience that I had with a praying mantis when I was a child. I stepped on one accidentally, and it crawled up my leg, pinching all the way up, and I had a pretty much a horrifying experience, and to this day, I am terrified of praying mantises, and I'd like your gentleman there to be psychologists for a minute. And tell me how I can get over the fear of praying mantises if I find them in my garden.
Oh, Heidi, what a crazy experience.
Yeah.
That's unfortunate.
You know, and some of those early childhood memories, like seeing rats at the bottom of the chicken food barrel, they just stick with us. And I can shiver yet at the thought of rats, and you can shiver at the thought of praying mantises. You know, this is something that comes up every once in a while about therapies to overcome fear of spiders. And one of the techniques they talk about is gradually introducing yourself to the topic. And this is outside my area of expertise, so take with the entire shaker of salt what I say. But one of the things to do is just start hanging pictures of praying mantids in your house. You know, hang up one where you'll see it every once in a while and move it around and hang up another one. Eventually, in these kinds of therapies, they bring one in a cage and they put it on the far side of the room and they make you stay in the room with it. So I think this gradual introduction to the topic is one of the major theories, therapies we hear about for overcoming it. But I don't know that it's going to work. So,
right. And they're, as you said, they're relatively common, but not everywhere. So maybe just avoiding them.
It might be that we could just go through life and not see one again. And I don't see one every year in my backyard. I don't have a vegetable garden. And I think the more sunshine you have, it seems like that sort of helps them be around. But I can go years and not see one outside in my own yard. I encounter them in other places as I travel around, but I think it's sort of easy to avoid them. And because they blend in with their environment, it's often they will be there and you won't even know it. And that's a good thing for you.
Yeah. Well, Heidi, I am sorry that you had to go through that. That sounds awful. Thanks a lot for your call. We have a lot of people with interesting praying mantis stories. This one's from Sarah on Twitter. Once Mass was interrupted by a praying mantis strolling across the altar, a Eucharistic minister scooped her up and set her free.
Uh-huh.
And this one's from Natalie. Last year, the furnace in our house quit working during the Christmas season. It got down into the 40s in the house before it was back up and running. And we had a live Christmas tree that had praying mantis egg sac on it. They hatched when it warmed back up and were running around the living room.
That's been the experience in my office, that I thought I had a praying mantis egg case that was old and dried up. But
It was not.
And you come to the office on Monday morning and, oh, isn't that cute? There's a praying mantis on the pencil sharpener. Oh, there's six of them over there on the book. And they're everywhere. But Christmas trees are an interesting thing. They're part of the natural world, and the natural world is a part of them. And when we bring in a live cut Christmas tree, we can bring in things like praying mantis egg cases.
Another question. Each fall about this time, praying mantises are abundant at the outdoor tennis courts at the University of Iowa. There are so many that when the lights are on, they need to be swatted away as one is playing. Why would they gather in this area?
They love Hawkeyes, I guess. It's the time of the year that they're there. You're talking about a fairly natural setting where there's lots of trees, there's lots of a variety of habitats where they could live, and attracted to lights seems to be what they do. And I don't know what the significance of that would be, but the ones I most commonly find in Ames, I find at the mall around the parking lot lights. So that's just the way they behave.
It really doesn't seem like a great place for them, but
no, and of course, there's this interesting thing that when a female is mated and she starts to grow to produce the egg sac, she can no longer fly. And oftentimes what we're seeing, especially later in the season, flying around the lights, are the males. And they have this long, skinny abdomen compared to the wide abdomen of the female where the egg sac was produced. So they may not be worth much to us because they're the males that are flying to the lights later on in the season.
Interesting. All right, we are moving on to a plant question, Richard. This is okay. Your turn. Archie is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Archie.
Hi.
What's your question?
Is it possible to kill a tomato plant by overwatering?
It's possible. It would be difficult, but possible. Basically, if you kept the ground saturated, you're basically going to suffocate the roots. They're going to drown. And so obviously it could. They adapt pretty well to wet conditions, but yes, if you keep it basically saturated for long periods, yes, they can drown. They can die.
Oh, all right. I had one, and the leaves just started to shrivel up, and it did. We got some tomatoes off of it, but it eventually just gave up.
Well, I would also say, though, they're susceptible to several diseases, both foliar diseases and vascular diseases. So they can die for other reasons, too. For example, they can get a vascular wilt and very suddenly wilt and die, and it has nothing to do with moisture.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay. Well, the other thing is the soil that we have. I live at Scottish Rite Park in Des Moines, and we have raised beds, and they have put compost in there.
Mm-hmm.
That's the soil, and I'm not used to that, but that may have had something to do with it, too,
well,
I suppose.
Well, that helps to retain moisture, but if you think you might have a disease problem, it would be wise to plant your tomatoes somewhere else next spring, just because these pathogens tend to stay in the soil.
Okay, yeah, that's good. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Archie. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Rod is up next in Dubuque. We're back to bugs. Hi, Rod.
Hello, Donald.
Yep.
I'd like to know what the name of the small black bug that eats into ripe muskmelons is.
Yeah, it's shiny, almost patent leather, black. Sometimes they...
Not very big.
Right.
Real small.
Oh, we're talking at least 3/16 of an inch to a quarter of an inch, aren't we?
Yeah.
Oblong shape and four yellow dots on them on the back. The common name the common name for that
no
is picnic bug. Picnic bug is
what?
The nickname picnic bug. They show up at a picnic where they attack the cut fruit, they attack your salads, they attack your fermenting beverages. The technical name for the species we've just described is four-spotted sap beetle, sap, S-A-P, because they also are attracted to tree wounds where the sap is running out, and that's where they feed on fermenting sugary materials. Now, in the case of your muskmelon and tomatoes, usually there has to be a crack or an opening for them to get started. But once they start, they wallow in whole hog. They're like pigs at a trough. They're elbowing each other aside, and they're just crawling their way into the flesh because there was an opening there already. And that increases the fermentation, and of course, that's what they want. Prompt, frequent harvest is one of the things we suggest. And also eliminating all cracked, damaged, overripe produce from the garden area.
Just to stop attracting more of them.
Don't attract more of them. Some people actually put a bait bucket outside their garden. They'll put their muskmelon rinds in a bucket over 10 feet away. What they're hoping is the muskmelon rinds are more attractive than the cracked tomatoes. I think these people are overly optimistic. But what we try to do is lure them away and make the garden as unattractive as possible through being very clean about our picking and pick a little early.
All right. Do you think that the bait bucket does any harm?
No, of course not.
All right. Now, when we talk about Japanese beetles, we've talked about bait possibly just attracting more. So in this case, you're just feeding some little black bugs?
You're feeding some of the little sap beetles and... You're giving them a happier place to live.
All right. So there may be a karmic payoff, at least.
Let's hope.
All right, Rod, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Sharon in Johnston. Hi, Sharon.
Good morning.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I have two quick questions. I live in an apartment complex, and I have lots of pots of plants. And one of the plants that I've fallen in love with is this tuberous begonia that I bought this spring, and I would like to bring it in and overwinter it in my apartment and then take it out in the spring again. And my second question is, I tried to get in when you were talking about potting plants and this. Is there a way that I could reuse my potting mix if I fertilize that pot? Except for the ones that I grow my tomatoes in, I realize I shouldn't do that. But I think it's pretty expensive to buy new potting mix every year. And I thought if I fertilize that pot, I could probably reuse the soil and grow my plants just as well.
Well, as far as the tuberous begonias, I guess you have two options. One is to simply leave it outside till you have a killing frost or freeze, let that destroy the plant, and then dig up the corm, or tuber, actually, and let it dry for a few days, and then store it in a small container and bury it in some vermiculite or wood shavings, and then store it in a cool place where the temperatures are like maybe 40 to 45, 50 degrees. And then in the spring, you can plant it in potting soil, and it should resprout. As far as bringing it inside as a house plant, you're probably going to have to give it some artificial lighting, because the plant's probably not going to get enough light by itself in a window. So you'll probably have to use at least a fluorescent light or some other fixture to give it some additional light. As far as the old potting soil, it's really not the fertilizer so much, it's the physical characteristics of the potting soil. Over time, they tend to decline, and so the growing conditions aren't quite as good. What you might want to do possibly is maybe mix some fresh potting soil with the old, okay, and that should maybe compensate for that.
Should I cut the tuberous begonia back any when I bring it in?
No, I would not. If you intend to bring it in as a house plant, just leave it as it is. You might want to maybe pinch off or cut off the flowers, just so the plant has a chance to maybe acclimate to indoor conditions. But I would not prune it back, no.
Okay. All right, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Sharon. Next up, we've got Tom in Cumming. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. See, I've got two questions. The first one is, if I'm trimming blue spruce and white pine, eastern white pine, what's the best time of the year to do that? And do I need to spray any kind of coating over the cuts to stop them from weeping? And my second question is, if I want to raise acorn trees from acorns, when is the optimum time for picking up the acorns? And is there a preference over the green or the brown acorn? And can I pick them directly off the tree?
Well, I would basically pick them as they fall and examine them immediately and see if you see a little hole in the acorn. If you do, that's not good. A small little weevil has basically destroyed that acorn. So make sure they're basically intact, no hole or damage, and then I would plant those immediately in the ground, maybe about a half inch deep or so. Some will actually germinate in the fall. Others wait till spring, but you need to get them in the ground as soon as possible. As far as the pruning off the branches on your spruce or pine, you could do that now if you wanted to. I'm assuming you're going to prune off the entire branch. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So prune it back to the branch collar. You could do it now. You could do it late winter, early spring. So you can do it now, but there is no need to apply any type of wound dressing or pruning paint to the cut surface. Just make a nice, clean cut just beyond the branch collar, and you're done.
Okay, very good. And on those acorns, brown or green, or does it matter?
I believe
bur oak.
Okay. I don't think the color matters that much. If they're falling naturally, they should be mature. Just make sure they don't have a hole in them.
All right, Tom, thanks so much for your call. Tom in Arcadia is next. Another Tom. Hi.
Hi.
What's your question?
Yes, on my sour cherry tree, do I prune that at all, and when would I prune it?
So it's a pie-type cherry?
Yes.
Okay. As far as pruning it, if you need to, I would do so in late March, early April, right before bud break. And you shouldn't have to do that much pruning, maybe some thinning possibly. You might have some branches that hang too low. You can prune those off, but you probably shouldn't have to do that much pruning.
Yeah, you don't do it like an apple tree.
Not so much, no, in comparison to apple, no.
Yeah, okay. Okay, yeah, that's all I needed.
All right, thanks a lot for your call, Tom. Here's a question from Amy on Facebook. She says, my son, who is 9, wants to know if you can keep a praying mantis as a pet. I hope the answer is no.
Gee, Mom, sorry to disappoint you, but they make great pets. And it's one of those life lessons that big things eat little things if they can catch them. They will only be a pet for a fixed period of time. And the disappointment of caring for a pet and watching it die in November may be reason enough not to start. But accepting that it's not a pet that's going to last through the school year like a gerbil or like a hermit crab, they make good pets. You can keep them in any kind of a box or a jar. And you just have to keep going out and finding crickets and grasshoppers and throwing it in there for them. But eventually we're going to get a frost and it's going to get cold in November, and finding something for them to eat is going to be harder and harder. And so now you're faced with, oh, it's going to starve to death anyway. Why did I start?
Well, maybe collecting an egg sack is a better idea. And then you have baby praying mantises in the spring that you get to release.
That's it. I like that idea.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. Iowa State University Extension entomologist Donald Lewis is here, along with Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Duran. You can join us 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Iowa State University entomology professor Donald Lewis and Iowa State University Extension horticulture specialist Richard Duran. They are here to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Amy, who was asking about keeping a praying mantis as a pet, had another question too. She said, we're also wondering what predators eat praying mantises, and can humans eat them?
Wow. Would I eat a praying mantis? I don't think there's going to be much there that would be digestible. When you think about how much of it is spiny leg that you're going to have to get out of the way before you launch into it, when you think about how much of it is the brittle wings, I don't think there's a lot of body left. I think you'd be better off eating things like grubs and mealworms and
grasshoppers and
grasshoppers.
Crickets.
Yeah. Eat the usual things. Who else would be a predator? I suspect birds eat them. And of course, we've already talked about the fact that as a newly hatched nymph, your major predator is going to be your brother and sister. That as they emerge from the egg case, there's about a day's head start that allows the nymphs to spread out, to kind of walk away. Because after that, they're going to start eating each other. Other predators would feed on them as well. Ladybugs might do it if they could catch them, and some of the others. But I think by and large, they're at the near the top of their food chain.
All right. Let's get back to the phones. Another Tom. Tom in Des Moines this time. Hi, Tom.
Hi, group. I have two questions.
Okay.
One about praying mantis and one about plants. And the praying mantis question is, do they change color to match their surroundings or just with age? I saw a couple of adults the other day that had brown wings, and I saw a younger one earlier this summer that was kind of a bright green.
I don't know that they change to match their surroundings, but I believe there is color change as they grow and as they mature. But also, there is just variation. I think they do start out more green in color. In the adult stage, they can be anywhere from tan to pale green. And then once they're in the adult stage, remember, most of what we see when we look at them are the wings covering the body. And the wings are tan with a green edge. So I think the adults do look more brown to us. But there's certainly enough green there for us to think, oh, yeah, that's a green praying mantis. But there is variation in them.
Okay. And then the plant question is, I bought a clump bamboo last year and planted it, and it's just not doing anything. It's staying about ground level. It's staying alive, but I can't get it to grow. I'm not sure what I did wrong.
Well, once you have it, usually it's there forever.
Yeah.
But as far as maybe encouraging it, make sure it has plenty of water. This has been a dry year. And maybe give it some fertilizer next spring and see how it responds. But it's been extremely dry this year in many parts of Iowa. So keep on watering it periodically until basically November and see what it does next spring.
All right. And once you get it going, make sure you can contain it.
Right. That may be the next step. Yes.
All right. Wolf is on the line in Solon. Hi, Wolf.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah, I got a couple questions for Richard. Not maybe they've been answered, but I don't know if I missed it. But I got a sunset maple that I want to, it's got a nice sprout growing underneath it, and I want to transplant it.
Now, when you say a sprout, meaning at the base of the trunk, or?
No, it's off to the side. It's like from one of those, helicopter propeller things.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's probably, half an inch in diameter and maybe 4 or 5, 10 or 12 inches tall. And I want to transplant it in another location so I can get another one growing. And it looks pretty healthy.
Okay.
I just want a good time to transplant that.
Well, if this is a seedling, it's not going to give you a perfect copy of the parent. It's going to be genetically different. Uh-huh. So it may not have the same color as far as the fall color. It may not grow as well, so that type of thing. But as far as moving it, I think what I would do initially would be to put something around it, like maybe some chicken wire or hardware cloth this fall, so the rabbits don't browse on it and destroy it. And then I would dig it up early next spring before it leaves out.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's cool. Good. And the other question is, I got a bleeding heart, two of them, and they're getting really big. When's a good time to transplant those? I've heard that, after they kind of lose their summer foliage, that'd be a good time. Is that correct?
If it's a common bleeding heart, I guess I would be inclined to dig it up promptly at the very first sign of growth early next spring. So go out there periodically. When you start to see some new growth, dig it up immediately and transplant it back into the ground and keep it well watered.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Wolf. And we've got a lot of email questions here. This one's from Andrea. I think I had a large batch of milkweed bugs eating lots of plants this summer. I did 2 applications of pyrethrum, which did help, but I haven't seen any monarchs or caterpillars since. Have I ruined my chances of attracting butterflies in the future by using this insecticide?
No, not at all. Pyrethrum is a very short-lived insecticide that only kills on contact. When you spray it on the plant, if it hit something like a box elder bug nymph, there's kind of a 50-50 chance it would have killed it. And moments later, that insecticide would have been deactivated and no longer effective. So, no, you've not hurt that. Box elder bug is probably more likely than milkweed bug if you saw them on lots of things. Milkweed bugs, oddly enough, only feed on milkweeds. Box elder bugs are not quite as specific, and we see them on flowers and vines and shrubs and other parts of the garden. So either way, they weren't causing much harm, and the good news is you didn't cause much harm by trying to kill some of them.
All right. This is from Tyler. Dobson flies look like spawns of Satan, but I know nothing about them. Can you expand my knowledge?
Dobson fly is an ugly insect. Even entomologists look at Dobson flies and think they're ugly. And if you see the Dobson fly larva that lives under the rocks in the river, the larva is called the helgramite. And I think that's even a better name for something that's downright ugly. But Dobson flies are river insects. They live as a larva for 1 to 3 years under the rocks in the river where they eat other small arthropods that are floating by. Then they emerge as these grayish-colored insects in the middle of the summer that are about 2 to 3 inches long. But when you look at them, the wings are 2 to 3 inches long, but the body's more like 3/4 of an inch. They're all wing. The other characteristic is they're all pincher. The males have pinchers on the front of the head that are 1 inch long and pretty ineffective. The females have these little 1/4-inch pinchers that actually could hurt you if you got your finger down in the wrong spot in front of them. Dobson flies are attracted to lights, and often we find them long distances from the rivers, but every Dobson fly we find spent the first 1 to 3 years of its life in the mud, under the rocks, at the bottom of the river.
That's a long life for an insect.
You know, it is. It's not the longest, but there's quite a range there of 1 to 3 years, and so I think a lot of it depends on water temperature and available food and some other things. Water quality may affect them as well. But this is another one like mayflies. If you have them in the river, it's a good thing because it indicates the water is high quality.
All right. Here's a question from Laura in Waterloo. I have a weed-infested lawn. I know I should think about reseeding or overseeding now, but I've also heard on the program to combat Creeping Charlie with a broadleaf herbicide twice this fall. What's the timing of all this to help me restore my sad lawn?
Okay. Well, if you have a situation where you have greater than 50% grass, we would try to keep the grass and kill the weeds. And as far as applying a broadleaf herbicide, we basically want to do that sometime between late September and early November. That's the time period. Fall applications are much more effective. Now, as far as ground ivy or Creeping Charlie, that takes two applications, typically about a month apart. So the first one should go on sometime around late September, early October, and the second one a month later. And typically with the ground ivy, you want to use a product that contains triclopyr, which is spelled T-R-I-C-L-O-P-Y-R. And that's the most effective compound on ground ivy.
All right. And if you have more than 50% weeds, it's time to start over?
It's time to start over, yes, because you just can't save it. You can't salvage it. So in that case, you might, for example, use Roundup and destroy it and start over. You could till it. But basically, you have a situation that you can't really salvage.
All right. Here's an email from Joe in Taylor Ridge, Illinois. I have a white oak or a bur oak. It has the rounded lobes on the leaves, and this spring the leaves did not unfurl. They stayed dark green, and this summer the little mini acorns were dropping off of it. So I'm wondering if this was stress due to drought or what, and it's happened to all of my white oaks, young and old.
Boy, my first thought would be maybe it was exposed to maybe a broadleaf herbicide, possibly, when it was actually leafing out in the spring. And that could cause maybe some curling of the actual foliage, which would be a permanent thing. If that were the case, though, I think later on, as the tree keeps on growing, that some of the later leaves would be basically okay, where they would have a normal leaf, and just those exposed to the actual herbicide would be curled. Insect-wise, Donald, anything?
No, that doesn't really fit. The overall stress, overall decline is something that's really hard to imagine or something hard to get our hands around sometimes. This is where we rely on our arborists and foresters to make site visits, to look at the soil conditions, to look at the planting depth, to look at the condition of the tree overall, and help us out with a site visit. So my encouragement would be contact a tree care professional and see if they can do a site visit to determine what might be going on.
All right, let's get back to the phones. Patty is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Patty.
Hi, I know to overseed this time of year, do I rake it in and water it, or do I just throw it onto the grass?
Well, you have to get the seed somehow into the soil. If it's a small area, you could probably go out with the rake. But it's been so dry recently, what you're probably going to have to do is maybe water it and then maybe come back in a couple of days, rake it. So you kind of break the soil surface and then sow your seed and then very lightly work the seed into the soil. If it's a big area that you want to overseed, you're going to have a machine. And one way of doing that is to either rent or have a lawn care service. Go ahead and core aerate your yard where they pull out plugs of soil. And then after doing that, you can go ahead and seed and then drag something across the surface. You could use a rake, you could use a piece of fencing and kind of break up the soil cores, keep the seed bed moist, and the grass seed will hopefully come up in a couple of weeks. But you do have to keep the seed bed moist. That's critical. The forecast, when you look ahead, it's kind of a dry September. So you're definitely going to have to water possibly once a day. You don't have to put on a lot of water. You just have to keep the upper surface moist.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Patty. Next up, we've got Dan in Somerville. Hi, Dan.
Hi, good morning. Hey, first got a comment for Donald. The praying mantises, are they louder than locusts?
They don't make a lot of noise. They zip and buzz when they're flying, but not when they're standing still. I think the katydids in my neighborhood win the prize for loudest noise, and they're followed in a close second by the annual cicadas that are still buzzing, but both of them are already in decline from their height of the summer.
Okay, thank you. Going to Richard. Richard, I had to take down a Bradbury pear a couple years ago because it had a big split in the trunk. And now I've got some shoots coming up out of the old trunk.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they're probably several of them, 7 feet tall, maybe an inch and a half in diameter. And I want them coming back to one. Is there a good time of year to do that?
Well, if I was going to do that, I would do that in early spring. I would wait until they start to leaf out, the buds start to break, and then select what I think is the best one as far as the most vigorous, the straightest, and keep that and remove the rest. Now, if these shoots are coming from the rootstock below the graft union, they're probably not going to give you the tree that you want. So, because that was a rootstock, it's not going to be the same tree. It might have thorns on it. It might produce big fruit. So it may not produce exactly what you want.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Dan. Max is next in Esterville. Hi, Max.
Hi. Excuse me. I have a question about hibiscus. I planted one about 6-7 years ago, and I call it a dinner plate red one.
Okay.
And I cut it down in the fall. It's outside. And each year, some more come up. And at this point, there's probably 20 of those big stalks come up.
Okay.
And it's 7 foot tall, and to keep it up, I just put a fence around it.
Okay.
Wow. That's
now,
good.
It's a beautiful plant, but it's so big now that I'd like to divide it.
Okay.
My question is, can I divide it? And if so, when?
I would do so next spring as soon as it first starts to come out of the ground.
Okay.
So basically let it come up a few inches, maybe 2 or 3 inches, and then at that point dig up the entire clump, take a large knife and cut it into sections, maybe 2 or 3, making sure that each section has at least 2 or 3 shoots.
All right. Max, thanks a lot for your call. And let's slip in. I'm going to ask Jeff's question for him. Do you know of any pecan trees he can plant and grow in Iowa?
We can grow those in the southern, let's say, third of Iowa.
He's in Indianola.
Oh, okay.
Right on the border.
Right on the border.
That doesn't sound good.
Well,
I can't
think of the name. There's a nut grower in southern Iowa that does sell nut trees, but I can't think of the name. Is it Tom Wall, possibly?
Hmm.
I don't know. But he does grow like chestnuts commercially, and I think he does sell some nut trees also.
All right, so look around for the nut growers in Iowa, Jeff, and ask your question. I also want to mention we are out of time, and thank you both for being here, but I'm really excited that I get to see you both in person on September 16th because we're going to be celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Horticulture Research Station. It's just north of Ames from 12:30 to 5 p.m. You can find more information online. It's a free event, and it's going to be so much fun, right?
Yes.
It'll be great, and the weather's going to cooperate this time.
All right. Iowa State University entomology professor Donald Lewis, Iowa State University Extension horticulture specialist Richard Duran, and we'll be back with Horticulture Day again next Friday. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.